The Golden Bough. A Study of Magic and Religion. By Sir James George Frazer. This audiobook was produced by Klaus-Dieter Mond, Rastatt, Germany and is published under the conditions of the Gutenberg Organization. Chapter 57. Public Scapegoats. Section 3. The Periodic Expulsion of Evils in a Material Vehicle. The mediate expulsion of evils by means of a scapegoat or other material vehicle, like the immediate expulsion of them in invisible form, tends to become periodic, and for a light reason. Thus every year, generally in March, the people of Leti, Mo, and Lakor, islands of the Indian archipelago, send away all their diseases to sea. They make a prow about 6 feet long, rig it with sails, oars, rudder, and other gear, and every family deposits in it some rice, fruit, a fowl, 2 eggs, insects that ravage the fields, and so on. Then they let it drift away to sea, saying, "Take away from here all kinds of sickness, take them to other islands, to other lands, distribute them in places that lie eastward, where the sun rises." The Bhyajas of Borneo annually send to sea a little bark laden with the sins and misfortunes of the people. The crew of any ship that falls in with the ill-omened bark at sea will suffer all the sorrows with which it is laden. A like custom is annually observed by the Dusuns of the Tauran district in British North Borneo. The ceremony is the most important of the whole year. Its aim is to bring good luck to the village during the ensuing year by solemnly expelling all the evil spirits that may have collected in or about the houses throughout the last 12 months. The task of routing out the demons and banishing them devolves chiefly on women. Dressed in their finest array, they go in procession through the village. One of them carries a small sucking pig in a basket on her back. And all of them bear wands, with which they belabor the little pig at the appropriate moment. Its squeals help to attract the vagrant spirits. At every house the women dance and sing, clashing castanets or cymbals of brass and jingling bunches of little brass bells in both hands. When the performance has been repeated at every house in the village, the procession defiles down to the river, and all the evil spirits, which the performers have chased from the houses, follow them to the edge of the water. There a raft has been made ready and moored to the bank. It contains offerings of food, cloth, cooking pots, and swords. And the deck is crowded with figures of men, women, animals, and birds, all made out of the leaves of a sago palm. The evil spirits now embark on the raft, and when they are all aboard, it is pushed off and allowed to float down with the current, carrying the demons with it. Should the raft run aground near the village, it is shoved off with all speed, lest the invisible passengers should seize the opportunity of landing and returning to the village. Finally, the sufferings of the little pig, whose squeals served to decoy the demons from their lurking places, are terminated by death, for it is killed and its carcass thrown away. Every year, at the beginning of the dry season, the Nicobar Islanders carry the model of a ship through their villages. The devils are chased out of the huts, and driven on board the little ship, which is then launched and suffered to sail away with wind. The ceremony has been described by a catechist, who witnessed it at Karnakabar in July 1897. For 3 days the people were busy preparing 2 very large floating cars, shaped like conos, fitted with sails, and loaded with certain leaves, which possessed the valuable property of expelling devils. While the young people were thus engaged, the exorcists and the elders sat in the house singing songs by turns. But often they would come forth, pace the beach armed with rods, and forbid the devil to enter the village. The 4th day of the solemnity bore a name which means, expelling the devil by sails. In the evening all the villagers assembled, the women bringing baskets of ashes and bunches of devil-expelling leaves. These leaves were then distributed to everybody, old and young. When all was ready, a band of robust men, attended by a guard of exorcists, carried one of the cars down to the sea on the right side of the village graveyard, and set it floating in the water. As soon as they had returned, another band of men carried the other car to the beach and floated it similarly in the sea to the left of the graveyard. The demon-laden barks being now launched, the women threw ashes from the shore, and the whole crowd shouted, saying, "Fly away, devil, fly away, never come again." The wind and the tide being favorable, the Conno sailed quickly away. And that night all the people feasted together with great joy, because the devil had departed in the direction of Chara. A similar expulsion of devils takes place once a year in other Nicobar villages. But the ceremonies are held at different times in different places. Amongst many of the aboriginal tribes of China, a great festival is celebrated in the third month of every year. It is held by way of a general rejoicing over what the people believe to be a total annihilation of the ills of the past 12 months. The destruction is supposed to be effected in the following way. A large earthenware jar filled with gunpowder, stones, and bits of iron is buried in the earth. A train of gunpowder, communicating with the jar, is then laid. And a match being applied, the jar and its contents are blown up. The stones and bits of iron represent the ills and disasters of the past year, and the dispersion of them by the explosion is believed to remove the ills and disasters themselves. The festival is attended with much reveling and drunkenness. At Old Calabar on the coast of Guinea, the devils and ghosts are, or used to be, publicly expelled once in 2 years. Among the spirits thus driven from their haunts are the souls of all the people who died since the last lustration of the town. About 3 weeks or a month before the expulsion, which according to one account takes place in the month of November, rude effigies representing men and animals, such as crocodiles, leopards, elephants, bullocks, and birds, are made of wicker work or wood, and being hung with strips of cloth and bedizened with jowgawas, are set before the door of every house. About 3 o'clock in the morning of the day appointed for the ceremony, the whole population turns out into the streets, and proceeds with a deafening uproar and in a state of the wildest excitement to drive all lurking devils and ghosts into the effigies, in order that they may be banished with them from the abodes of men. For this purpose, bands of people roam through the streets knocking on doors, firing guns, beating drums, blowing on horns, ringing bells, clattering pots and pans, shouting and hallooing with might and main, in short, making all the noise it is possible for them to raise. The hubbub goes on till the approach of dawn, when it gradually subsides and ceases altogether at sunrise. By this time the houses have been thoroughly swept, and all the frightened spirits are supposed to have huddled into the effigies or their fluttering drapery. In these wicker figures are also deposited the sweepings of the houses and the ashes of yesterday's fires. Then the demon-laden images are hastily snatched up, carried in tumultuous procession down to the brink of the river, and thrown into the water to the tuck of drums. The ebb tide bears them away seaward, and thus the town is swept clean of ghosts and devils for another 2 years. Similar annual expulsions of embodied evils are not unknown in Europe. On the evening of Easter Sunday, the gypsies of southern Europe take a wooden vessel like a bandbox, which rests cradle-wise on 2 cross pieces of wood. In this they place herbs and simples, together with the dried carcass of a snake, or lizard, which every person present must first have touched with his fingers. The vessel is then wrapped in white and red wool, carried by the oldest man from tent to tent, and finally thrown into running water, not, however, before every member of the band has spat into it once, and the sorceress has uttered some spells over it. They believe that by performing this ceremony they dispel all the illnesses that would otherwise have afflicted them in the course of the year. And that if anyone finds the vessel and opens it out of curiosity, he and his will be visited by all the maladies which the others have escaped. The scapegoat by means of which the accumulated ills of a whole year are publicly expelled is sometimes an animal. For example, among the Garas of Assam, besides the sacrifices for individual cases of illness, there are certain ceremonies which are observed once a year by a whole community or village, and are intended to safeguard its members from dangers of the forest, and from sickness and mishap during the coming 12 months. The principal of these is the Asong Tao Ta ceremony. Close to the outskirts of every big village, a number of stones may be noticed stuck into the ground, apparently without order or method. These are known by the name of asong, and on them is offered the sacrifice which the asong tatar demands. The sacrifice of a goat takes place, and a month later, that of a langur, entellus monkey, or a bamburad is considered necessary. The animal chosen has a rope fastened round its neck and is led by two men, one on each side of it, to every house in the village. It is taken inside each house in turn, the assembled villagers, meanwhile, beating the walls from the outside, to frighten and drive out any evil spirits which may have taken up their residence within. The round of the village having been made in this manner, the monkey or rat is led to the outskirts of the village, killed by a blow of a dao, which disembowels it, and then crucified on bamboos set up in the ground. Round the crucified animal long, sharp bamboo stakes are placed, which form kevalks to frise round about it. These commemorate the days when such defences surrounded the villages on all sides to keep off human enemies, and they are now a symbol to ward off sickness and dangers to life from the wild animals of the forest. The langur required for the purpose is hunted down some days before, but should it be found impossible to catch one, a brown monkey may take its place. A hullock may not be used. Here the crucified ape or rat is the public scapegoat, which by its vicarious sufferings and death relieves the people from all sickness and mishap in the coming year. Again, on one day of the year the Potius of Jahar, in the western Himalayas, take a dog, intoxicate him with spirits and tang or hemp, and having fed him with sweetmeats, lead him round the village and let him loose. They then chase and kill him with sticks and stones, and believe that, when they have done so, no disease or misfortune will visit the village during the year. In some parts of Breedalbane it was formerly the custom on New Year's Day to take a dog to the door, give him a bit of bread, and drive him out, saying, "Get away, you dog." Whatever death of men or loss of cattle would happen in this house to the end of the present year, may it all light on your head. On the Day of Atonement, which was the 10th day of the 7th month, the Jewish high priest laid both his hands on the head of a live goat, confessed over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel, and, having thereby transferred the sins of the people to the beast, sent it away into the wilderness. The scapegoat upon whom the sins of the people are periodically laid, may also be a human being. At Onitsha, on the Niger, two human beings used to be annually sacrificed to take away the sins of the land. The victims were purchased by public subscription. All persons who, during the past year, had fallen into gross sins, such as incendiarism, theft, adultery, witchcraft, and so forth, were expected to contribute 28 nugas, or a little over £2. The money thus collected was taken into the interior of the country and expended in the purchase of two sickly persons, to be offered as a sacrifice for all these abominable crimes, one for the land and one for the river. A man from a neighboring town was hired to put them to death. On the 27th of February 1858, the Reverend J.C. Taylor witnessed the sacrifice of one of these victims. The sufferer was a woman, about 19 or 20 years of age. They dragged her alive along the ground, face downwards, from the king's house to the river, a distance of 2 miles, the crowds who accompanied her crying, "Wickedness! Wickedness!" The intention was to take away the iniquities of the land. The body was dragged along in a merciless manner, as if the weight of all their wickedness was thus carried away. Similar customs are said to be still secretly practiced every year by many tribes in the delta of the Niger in spite of the vigilance of the British government. Among the Yoruba Negroes of West Africa, the human victim chosen for sacrifice, and who may be either a freeborn or a slave, a person of noble or wealthy parentage, or one of humble birth, is, after he has been chosen and marked out for the purpose, called a nolamu. He is always well fed and nourished and supplied with whatever he should desire during the period of his confinement. When the occasion arrives for him to be sacrificed and offered up, He is commonly led about and paraded through the streets of the town or city of the sovereign who would sacrifice him for the well-being of his government and of every family and individual under it, in order that he might carry off the sin, guilt, misfortune and death of all without exception. Ashes and chalk would be employed to hide his identity by the one being freely thrown over his head, and his face painted with the latter, whilst individuals would often rush out of their houses to lay their hands upon him that they might thus transfer to him their sin, guilt, trouble, and death. This parade over, he is taken to an inner sanctuary and beheaded. His last words or dying groans are the signal for an outburst of joy among the people assembled outside, who believe that the sacrifice has been accepted and the divine wrath appeased. In Siam it used to be the custom on one day of the year to single out a woman broken down by debauchery, and carry her on a litter through all the streets to the music of drums and hautboys. The mob insulted her and pelted her with dirt. And after having carried her through the whole city, they threw her on a dunghill or a hedge of thorns outside the ramparts, forbidding her ever to enter the walls again. They believed that the woman thus drew upon herself all the malign influences of the errand of evil spirits. The buttocks of Sumatra offer either a red horse or a buffalo as a public sacrifice to purify the land and obtain the favor of the gods. Formerly, it is said, a man was bound to the same stake as the buffalo, and when they killed the animal, the man was driven away. No one might receive him, converse with him, or give him food. Doubtless he was supposed to carry away the sins and misfortunes of the people. Sometimes the scapegoat is a divine animal. The people of Malabar share the Hindu reverence for the cow, to kill and eat which, they esteem to be a crime as heinous as homicide or willful murder. Nevertheless the Brahmins transfer the sins of the people into one or more cows, which are then carried away, both the cows and the sins wherewith these beasts are charged, to what place the Brahmin shall appoint. When the ancient Egyptians sacrificed a bull, they invoked upon its head all the evils that might otherwise befall themselves in the land of Egypt, and thereupon they either sold the bull's head to the Greeks or cast it into the river. Now, it cannot be said that in the times known to us the Egyptians worshipped bulls in general, for they seem to have commonly killed and eaten them. But a good many circumstances point to the conclusion that originally all cattle, bulls as well as cows, were held sacred by the Egyptians. For not only were all cows esteemed holy by them and never sacrificed, but even bulls might not be sacrificed unless they had certain natural marks. A priest examined every bull before it was sacrificed. If it had the proper marks, he put his seal on the animal in token that it might be sacrificed. And if a man sacrificed a bull which had not been sealed, he was put to death. Moreover, the worship of the black bulls Apis and Mnevis, especially the former, played an important part in Egyptian religion. All bulls that died a natural death were carefully buried in the suburbs of the cities, and their bones were afterwards collected from all parts of Egypt and interred in a single spot. And at the sacrifice of a bull in the great rites of Isis all the worshippers beat their breasts and mourned. On the whole, then, we are perhaps entitled to infer that bulls were originally, as cows were always, esteemed sacred by the Egyptians, and that the slain bull upon whose head they laid the misfortunes of the people was once a divine scapegoat. It seems not improbable that the lamb annually slain by the Madis of Central Africa is a divine scapegoat. And the same supposition may partly explain the Zani sacrifice of the turtle. Lastly, the scapegoat may be a divine man. Thus, in November the gods of India worship Kansayam Dio, the protector of the crops, and at the festival the god himself is said to descend on the head of one of the worshippers, who is suddenly seized with a kind of fit and, after staggering about, rushes off into the jungle, where it is believed that, if left to himself, he would die mad. However, they bring him back, but he does not recover his senses for 1 or 2 days. The people think that one man is thus singled out as a scapegoat for the sins of the rest of the village. In the Temple of the Moon the Albanians of the Eastern Caucasus kept a number of sacred slaves, of whom many were inspired and prophesied. When one of these men exhibited more than usual symptoms of inspiration or insanity, and wandered solitary up and down the woods, like the Gond in the jungle, the high priest had him bound with a sacred chain and maintained him in luxury for a year. At the end of the year he was anointed with unguents and led forth to be sacrificed. A man whose business it was to slay these human victims and to whom practice had given dexterity, advanced from the crowd and thrust a sacred spear into the victim's side, piercing his heart. From the manner in which the slain man fell, omens were drawn as to the welfare of the commonwealth. Then the body was carried to a certain spot where all the people stood upon it as a purificatory ceremony. This last circumstance clearly indicates that the sins of the people were transferred to the victim, just as the Jewish priest transferred the sins of the people to the scapegoat by laying his hands on the animal's head. And since the man was believed to be possessed by the divine spirit, we have here an undoubted example of a man God slain to take away the sins and misfortunes of the people. In Tibet, the ceremony of the scapegoat presents some remarkable features. The Tibetan New Year begins with the new moon, which appears about the 15th of February. For 23 days afterwards, the government of Lhasa, the capital, is taken out of the hands of the ordinary rulers and entrusted to the monk of the Dabang monastery, who offers to pay the highest sum for the privilege. The successful bidder is called the Jalno, and he announces his accession to power in person, going through the streets of Lhasa with a silver stick in his hand. Monks from all the neighboring monasteries and temples assemble to pay him homage. The Jalno exercises his authority in the most arbitrary manner for his own benefit, as all the fines which he exacts are his by purchase. The profit he makes is about 10 times the amount of the purchase money. His men go about the streets in order to discover any conduct on the part of the inhabitants that can be found fault with. Every house in Lhasa is taxed at this time, and the slightest offence is punished with unsparing rigor by fines. This severity of the Jalno drives all working classes out of the city till the 23 days are over. But if the laity go out, the clergy come in. All the Buddhist monasteries of the country 4 miles round about open their gates and disgorge their inmates. All the roads that lead down into Lhasa from the neighboring mountains are full of monks hurrying to the capital, some on foot, some on horseback, some riding asses or lowing oxen, all carrying the prayer books and culinary utensils. In such multitudes do they come that the streets and squares of the city are encumbered with their swarms, and incarnadined with their red cloaks. The disorder and confusion are indescribable. Bands of the holy men traverse the streets chanting prayers, or uttering wild cries. They meet, they jostle, they quarrel, they fight. Bloody noses, black eyes, and broken heads are freely given and received. All day long, too, from before the peep of dawn till after darkness has fallen, these red-cloaked monks hold services in the dim incense-laden air of the great Mukundranath temple, the cathedral of Lhasa. And thither they crowd thrice a day to receive their doles of tea and soup and money. The cathedral is a vast building, standing in the center of the city, and surrounded by bazaars and shops. The idols in it are richly inlaid with gold and precious stones. 24 days after the Jalno has ceased to have authority, he assumes it again, and for 10 days acts in the same arbitrary manner as before. On the first of the 10 days the priests again assemble at the cathedral, pray to the gods to prevent sickness and other evils among the people, and, as a peace offering, sacrifice one man. The man is not killed purposely, but the ceremony he undergoes often proves fatal. Grain is thrown against his head, and his face is painted half white, half black. Thus grotesquely disguised, and carrying a coat of skin on his arm, he is called the King of the Years, and sits daily in the marketplace, where he helps himself to whatever he likes and goes about shaking a black yak's tail over the people, who thus transfer their bad luck to him. On the 10th day, all the troops in Lhasa march to the great temple and form in line before it. The King of the Years is brought forth from the temple and receives small donations from the assembled multitude. He then ridicules the Jalno, saying to him, What we perceive through the five senses is no illusion. All you teach isn't true, and the like. The Jalno, who represents the Grand Lama for the time being, contests these heretical opinions. The dispute waxes warm, and at last both agree to decide the questions at issue by a cast of the dice, the Jalno offering to change places with the scapegoat should the throw be against him. If the King of the Years wins, much evil is prognosticated. But if the Jalno wins, there is great rejoicing, for it proves that his adversary has been accepted by the gods as a victim to bear all the sins of the people of Lhasa. Fortune, however, always favors the Jalno, who throws sixes with unvarying success, while his opponent turns up only ones. Nor is this so extraordinary as at first sight it might appear. For the Jalno's dice are marked with nothing but sixes and his adversaries with nothing but ones. When he sees the finger of Providence thus plainly pointed against him, the King of the Years is terrified and flees away upon a white horse, with a white dog, a white bird, salt, and so forth, which have all been provided for him by the government. His face is still painted half white and half black, and he still wears his Elethan coat. The whole populace pursues him, hooting, yelling, and firing blank shots in volleys after him. Thus driven out of the city, he is detained for 7 days in the great chamber of horrors at the Samyas monastery, surrounded by monstrous and terrific images of devils and skins of huge serpents and wild beasts. Thence he goes away into the mountains of Chedang, where he has to remain an outcast for several months or a year in a narrow den. If he dies before the time is out, the people say it is an auspicious omen. But if he survives, he may return to Lhasa and play the part of scapegoat over again the following year. This quaint ceremonial, still annually observed in the secluded capital of Buddhism, the Rome of Asia, is interesting because it exhibits, in a clearly marked religious stratification, a series of divine redeems themselves redeemed, of vicarious sacrifices vicariously atoned for, of gods undergoing a process of fossilization, who, while they retain the privileges, have dispersed end themselves of the pains and penalties of divinity. In the Jalno we may without undue straining discern a successor of those temporary kings, those mortal gods, who purchase a short lease of power and glory at the price of their lives. That he is the temporary substitute of the Grand Lama is certain. That he is, or was once, liable to act as scapegoat for the people is made nearly certain by his offer to change places with the real scapegoat, the King of the Years, if the arbitrament of the dice should go against him. It is true that the conditions under which the question is now put to the hazard have reduced the offer to an idle form. But such forms are no mere mushroom growths, springing up of themselves in a night. If they are now lifeless formalities, empty husks devoid of significance, we may be sure that they once had a life and a meaning. If at the present day they are blind alleys leading nowhere, we may be certain that in former days they were paths that led somewhere, if only to death. That death was the goal to which of old the Tibetan scapegoat passed after his brief period of license in the marketplace, is a conjecture that has much to commend it. Analogy suggests it. The blank shots fired after him, the statement that the ceremony often proves fatal, the belief that his death is a happy omen, all confirm it. We need not wonder then that the Jalno, after paying so dear to act as deputy deity for a few weeks, should have preferred to die by deputy rather than in his own person when his time was up. The painful but necessary duty was accordingly laid on some poor devil, some social outcast, some wretch with whom the world had gone hard, who readily agreed to throw away his life at the end of a few days if only he might have his fling in the meantime. For observe that while the time allowed to the original deputy the Jalno was measured by weeks, the time allowed to the deputy's deputy was cut down to days, 10 days according to one authority, 7 days according to another. So short a rope was doubtless thought a long enough tether for so black or sickly a sheep. So few sands in the hourglass, slipping so fast away, sufficed for one who had wasted so many precious years. Hence in the jack-pudding who now masquerades with motley countenance in the marketplace of Lhasa, sweeping up misfortune with a black yak's tail, we may fairly see the substitute of a substitute, the vicar of a vicar, the proxy on whose back the heavy burden was laid when it had been lifted from nobler shoulders. But the clue, if we have followed it aright, does not stop at the Jalno. It leads straight back to the Pope of Lhasa himself, the Grand Lama, of whom the Jalno is merely the temporary vicar. The analogy of many customs in many lands points to the conclusion that, if this human divinity stoops to resign his ghostly power for a time into the hands of a substitute, it is, or rather was once, for no other reason than that the substitute might die in his stead. Thus through the mist of ages unillumined by the lamp of history, the tragic figure of the Pope of Buddhism, God's vicar on earth for Asia, looms dim and sad as the man God who bore his people's sorrows, the good shepherd who laid down his life for the sheep.